It's me, Dan, from Harmontown. You can hear episodes of our show and 30 others before anyone else on TuneIn First Play. The TuneIn app is a free mobile audio app available across iOS, Android, and Windows. Podcast superfans get even more from their favorite shows. For 4 weeks, new episodes of Harmontown will be available a full 24 hours early, exclusively on TuneIn. Podcasts will release their new episodes early, including feral audio shows like Drinky Fun Time, Dome People Town, and Natch Butte. TuneIn is also full of content like live sports, news, music, and audiobooks. Get the next episode of Harmontown right now at the TuneIn app at tunein.com/Harmontown.
Feral Audio.
Listening to Twisting the Wind.
Hey, this is Twisting the
Just making sounds right now. That's what they tell people to get them to stop using sorcerers and fakers and mystics. Yo, this is Jack Daniels Griller, Chief CEO, General Manager, Ben Frunk. Ben Junkst, Ben Snyong. Welcome to Twisting the Wind. That's something we know you got.
Oh, now we sound normal, right? Now we sound like how it's supposed to be. Hey, everyone. I'm Johnny Pemberton. Welcome to Twisting the Wind, or also known as Twisting the Wind, also known as Twisting the Wind, or any other way you want to inflect it. That's a fun thing to do in normal life and regular life. It's just change up where you put that emphasis. You know, like my name is Johnny Pemberton. It's hard to say. It's a very difficult name to pronounce. Johnny Pemberton. But some people say Johnny Pemberton. Actually, no one says that unless they're maybe someone who's new to English and they are a substitute teacher in a class that I'm not taking because I'm not substituting in a. I'm not a person who's in those doing a. I'm not getting subbed in. No more do I do to get me in there with the sub boy. Okay. You're listening to Twisting the Wind. You know that. I've said that many times. You said who the host is.
Did you say who the host was? Did you tell them who you are?
Yeah, I identified myself.
Good. That's the first part of responsible journalism is identifying yourself the same way that Anderson Cooper does that, Wolf Blitzer. They make sure you know that they are who they are, like by either having shocking hair and eyes that are clearly reptilian or by having a thick, thick, hoary beard and some wireframe glasses.
Cool. That's good. I'm glad I know how to be like those guys. If you're tuning in for the first time, this is a podcast all about trying to be like either Wolf Blitzer or Anderson Cooper. Wolf came first, but Anderson is clearly kind of taking the cake on that. America loves that type of man, especially when he expresses fake empathy in a natural disaster setting that everyone's sad about, even though it's probably the least death toll of anything he could be covering. But that's what this Whoa, why did you start talking about that, Pembs? That's what this podcast is all about. It's all about trying to be like Wolf Blitzer and trying to be like Anderson Cooper. Just kidding, it's not. It's just, it's a fucking blaster. It's a straight up Jamaican downtown slip snip, slip stitch and pass, fish fans. Yeah. So if you're listening for the first time, just buckle up. Just lay down in the delta groove and let the smooth wash candle over you until the wax drips, and you're gonna have a hard on by the time you get those ears out of the mold. So do that. If you're returning to Twitty Dwin, aka TT Dubs, aka my brother's baby's boy, aka the executive branch, buffet, hands on the branch, new one, my brother's baby boy. That is the new official third AKA for this show, my brother's baby boy. If you see me in person ever, please just say those words and I'll probably be like, what the fuck? And then you're gonna be like, Johnny, remember you said to say my brother's baby boy is like a cool, like, wink and a nod that you are a Twisting the Wind fan. And I'll be like, oh, did I? Because something happens when I record this podcast where I say something and then it immediately sends back this messenger ant into my brain and destroys the memory that was just created, because it's some sort of a thing. It's a thing that happens. Not always 100% super, totally, mega, completely true. But for the most part, if it sounds like it's free-flowing off the tip of the old tongue, that means it is, and it's just sort of a thing that happened. It's a wind that was twisted in that particular shape at that particular time and may not be particularly twisted in that way ever again. But you can kind of say that the way about everything, you know? I mean, a moment's a moment. You never play the same song twice. Is that what they say? Is that what Mark Twain said? I just realized recently that Mark Twain said one of my favorite quotes about the whole looking into the old abyss thing, you know? Found that out from the preamble to a streaming music video on a radio service. Wow. Wow. Good work there, Scholar Pemberton. Yeah. Twain. Well, I've talked about Mark Twain enough on this podcast. You fucking get it. Maybe you don't. Listen to some old episodes, goddammit. Thank you for listening. Thank you for coming back. If you haven't already and you want to and you feel the inclination, you got that deep old, you got that tangle. You got a little of that dangle tangle. You know what I'm talking about? You got a tangle, tangle. You got a dangling tangle tangle. It's all that. What it is is when you got that thing. You know, sometimes as a gentleman, you get that little dangle and you feel a tangle. But what happens is that tangle causes you to rearrange what's down there. You get those triplicates, two buddies in one little zone there. And you got that longer buddy who should be longer if he's dangling, and he's. He causes that to tangle. So what you did was a dangle, tangle, dangle. You tangled that dangle, dangle. You had a tangle that caused you to tangle the dangle. Well, better get on there and get down and wrangle. If that's the case with you, is that you? Do you have that problem? Well, then what I would suggest is rating and reviewing the podcast on iTunes or whatever other service it is you use to harvest this piece of audio. Fuck, oh, I had it there. I had the sentence. The sentence lost me. Whatever you use to harvest this audio product. No, I don't want to say product, because this is not vegetable, this audio wheat. This wheat. Whatever you use to harvest this audio wheat. That sounds stupid. Regardless, if you do rate and review the podcast and fucking subscribe, did you forget to subscribe? I know that's, did you forget to subscribe? If you didn't subscribe, do it now. Get your friends to do it. buy a bunch of fucking computers, buy like a big old bank of them, buy a big old fucking Goodwill bank of them, and set them up to just like monkeys, subscribe. And then you plug that fucking shit into, speakers. get some powered speakers and put them everywhere and just blast this wheat into the zones. Your tears will turn into dancing with the gifts of this finest audio wheat that has become harvested unto your table. Sproke, Carmen's to the Benjamins. So do all those things. Also, if you're a big fan, if you're a person who's enjoying this podcast, who's consuming it, donate. Go, it's very easy. People ask me on Twitter. People ask me stuff on, people, I mean, God love you. Or whatever love you. Sticks. Sticks are God. I think sticks are the new God. Sticks love you. See, you can't say that because people think about the fucking band Sticks. How about, large pieces of wood? Limbs love you. No, that sounds like, I'll just say wood. Pieces of wood love you. If you're a regular listener and really loving it, you gotta fucking pay the tithe, motherfucker. Put some tithe in the fucking velvet pouch, will ya? It's easy. I was asking about stuff. See, I totally just digressed on my own fucking point there. Is everything you need to know about the show, with the few exceptions, is listed on the Feral Audio page, except for the intro song, which is, you know, people ask, they're always going to be asking me that until I die. It's not my song, but, Feral Audio. So you go to Feral Audio, you go to the Twisting the Wind page on Feral Audio, and here's what you do. First, you click on that Amazon portal, because you're just going to do a little shopping. And when you do that shopping, because you're going to do it anyways, you're going to buy those fucking dog bones you need in a couple days, or whatever sort of physical monetary thing you're getting to fill up your storage shed. Buy it through Amazon, through us, okay? That helps out Feral Audio. It helps out the show. And you can donations are easy. You just click on that fucking button there and donate. It's all PayPal. It's all secure. It's all just sweet honey. It's all honey like a bunny got money. You know what I mean? That's what they say about that. That's it and that's all, baby. God, I keep thinking about stuff I want to talk to you about, but it keeps slipping away. I do want to talk about ants, though. Ants. I am having a fucking time with these little sugar ants. I left the home the other day and left for a couple hours, left the old home, and I, on the desk that I use at the house, that is not where I am right now, just so you know, I set a nearly finished tall boy of coconut water in a steel, those good old steel cans, you know. Come back home, and there is a fucking procession to this can. It is incredible. There's a big zag down the wall. It's going on the windowsill. It's like, how do they found a way to get to this desk, and they did it. And there are fucking hundreds of them, right? I mean, how do you count those little black specks? It's hard, because maybe there's 100,000. I just don't know. It's like, oh, is that what 100,000 looks like? Wow, you had me there. I would have said 25, but yeah, if you Mr. Ant Scientist say that's 100,000 ants there, well, you got me. So that's what happened. And this is not new to our house. So we have techniques. You spray them with some fucking vinegar window cleaner, and that just, for some reason, that just deads them instantly. And I know I talk a lot about in this podcast about ecology and bugs and how much I love bugs, which I really do. I never kill spiders. I mean, it's been said in fictitious lore and non-fictitious lore, it's bad luck. It's also just bad. Well, and side note, there's a couple spiders who I haven't killed who are living in this crooks of this desk that were having a goddamn feast. Like, I'm talking about 7 or 8 little of these baby sugar babies in there. And so that happened. I know I talk about that all the time, but there's something about this particular species of ant that I fucking hate, and here's why. These little bastards, when you smush them, or when you scare them, they let off a scent, which I gotta say, and on repeated, so many fucking viewings of getting this in my nose and on my hands, it is the worst smell in the entire fucking world. The alert pheromone from an ant, a tiny little sugar ant, it fucking is like, oh, I mean, it doesn't even make me want to vomit. I would prefer something that makes you want to vomit, because at least that's got like its... That's what that is. That's in that camp. These fucking little sugar babies, what is it? It's like a blaster death sweat. It's probably some sort of incredibly psychoactive drug. It is such a fucking terrible smell. And I implore you, if you haven't smelled this before, find a friend who's got some sugar ants problem, who's got all of his, everything he owns is in the fridge to combat these sugar ants, and he's spraying this fucking crap everywhere, losing his goddamn mind because they have troops out, the millions that are just waiting to find whatever little granule of starch or sugars in your house and just be like, okay, back it up! Find someone who's got that shit, and you squish one of these bastards, the smell is just, it's like this, it's like a fucking chemical that came out of nowhere. It's so, oh, I get it, guys. It works. I gotta give them props, though. See, I gotta give them credit, because what these little tiny things that are so small, they're kind of difficult to kill. You have to use, I mean, they're just tiny. They've created this. They can create this scent that it takes a mammal my size. I fucking can't handle it. Well, in the same sense, it's maybe like, maybe you'd have a nicer smell. I wouldn't want to kill you. I don't want to keep you around or something. I don't know. Either way, I'm going to say I'm sorry to the ant kingdom for just really, really hating on y'all. I mean, I really do. And they get in my garden sometimes. Like certain areas, if you go on vacation, they'll find an area that somehow has become dry, and they'll take it over. And you're pulling weeds, and next thing you know, you're covered in these little fuckers. And they're letting off that fucking whoop, 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 that freaking scent alarm. And it smells terrible. It smells like a fucking borax factory burned down. I don't know. It's got this chemically blast. That's all I wanted to say. Okay. But thank you so that's it. Here's the deal. There's more chances to see me live again. Who fucking knew? I'm going to be on this beautiful little not-so-mini tour with Duncan Trussell coming up in the second half of August. We literally are taking the entire second half of August. Literally. The second half. If you took August and seconded it in half, we're going to be places that entire second half. We're going to be in Atlanta. We're going to be in Chattanooga. We're going to be in Nashville. We're going to be in Charleston. We'll be in some other places, but that's basically it. So get on the calendar. I'll be back here with another episode of the podcast and a real fucking fiery display of classic rock and roll brutality and suaveness. We'll blast you a little information tour thing. But know that. Just prep yourself. Think about where you're going to be and look up where I'm going to be. I'm also headlining in Charleston and in Wilmington and I think one other place. Wow. Good. Really good, Pemberton. Really just great. Just definitely know things that are important to be factual about before you start. No. Dude, were you worried about the factual parts? No. Just barrel into it. Just fucking headlong barrel into it. Doesn't matter. No one's going to... Someone's going to notice? No, they're not going to notice because you're fucking... Yeah. So there you go. Wilmington and in Charleston, and I'll be headlining. And so that's going to kick off the tour. I'm by myself for a weekend for like 3 or 4 shows. And then Duncan's going to land via airplane or something. We're going to rent these multiple cars. We're going to doing this weird thing. We're going to lash them together. It's the new cool thing. I don't get it. It's a Southern thing. And we'll be all over the place. So check your local listings and come see us. And I'm going to have some... I swear to fucking God, I've said this 1,000 times, but this is for real. And this is the impetus. There will be merch. There will be merch. And know this. you can't attend, that's okay. That merch will be available other places. After it'll be, it's not going to be the only time the merch is available. It's obviously going to be an online. It's going to be an online thing. Excuse me, is this an online thing? Hi, is this an online thing? Great thing to do if you go any place. Just ask people that, and they think that they'll think you're being legitimate because it sounds right. How many people just don't know? Is this? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, this is an online thing. Okay. I'll go order at home and then come back to the restaurant. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, you're full? Oh, is this an online thing? Do I have to do an online thing first? Oh, I think because there's so many young people here. I could do that character all day, but I'm not going to do that
character all day because I want to introduce this guest.
Okay. So basically what happened is I intended to have a segment on the podcast here, talking to a garden expert because, as you know, I love talking about that garden. And through an email from a fan, which is twistingthewind@gmail.com, learned about this amazing farm in Canada called Goosefoot Farms, run by two brilliant horticulturalists, Ryan and Jessica. And they, Jessica contacted me, and I spoke with Ryan about, I wanted just to get some basic information about gardening. And next thing you know, we talk for almost an hour about, well, I mean, you can talk forever. You can talk for 1,000 years about this stuff because it's the most interesting thing that there is, because I've talked about this a little bit with some people, and we, even Ryan and I talked a little bit about this, but basically what I'm saying is that plants and everything like plants, they're aliens. They're aliens. It's just they're not like aliens. They are aliens. Everyone says, "Ooh, that's weird. That's like an alien. That's as though that was an alien. Oh, look how weird it is. It's like a little alien." It's not. It is an alien. It's all the they're all fuck. We're all just visitors on the same planet here. Just the same way that this dog right now that's whining at me. Rabbit, say hello. Did you hear that just now? That was the sound of sniffing. That was the sound of an alien that lives with me that sniffs. But or am I the alien that lives with her that sniffs? Either way, what is weird? I don't know. Ask a fucking pair of slugs mating if they think that what they're doing is weird. Ask any sort of weird biological proclivity. Do you think you're weird? Do it in a stupid British accent. And it's not going to say it thinks it's weird because it's not weird. So, aliens are real. Basically, what I'm trying to get to the point here is aliens are real. And I talked to Ryan Nasichuk of Goosefoot Farms, and we had a bonding experience in terms of plants. Okay, in terms of where the plants are and what they do. So enjoy it. Just ball up in it. Get it hot and ready. Get yourself hot and ready and enjoy this conversation. I learned so much stuff. In a way, I was about to say, like, look, even I learned something, but I'm like, what a dumb thing to say. That's one thing not true. Anytime you're in a position where you think you, don't have anything to learn, that's a bad place to be. That's sort of like a dangerous position to take. Like, okay, we'll see what this guy's got to teach me, because I don't think I've got anything to learn. I'm not saying I took that position, but I'm saying that sometimes, with certain things, you feel like you got it down, and then somebody is like, no, no, you have no idea. And that's how I feel about gardening, and especially this conversation. And, you know, I'm just belaboring the point here, right? I'm just taking a wedge and driving it between your ears and all these other poo-poos and stuff, you know? So a couple things you got to know real quick. Rate and review, subscribe, donate, buy shit on Amazon, recommend it to people, write it on sidewalk chalk, Twisting the Wind with Joni Pemberton. Thank you for listening. And, we'll be back with some more of everything you like. Did you know that?
Oh my God!
Ryan speaking.
Ryan, this is Joni Pemberton.
Hey, Joni Pemberton, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I'm great.
Cool.
I'm doing great. Just clearing some tea vines out of a bed here and getting ready to plant it with something else.
You're clearing what out exactly?
I'm pulling some pea vines out for the spinach for the sugar snap.
So did you?
Yeah, and getting ready to spinach.
Did you have those in there to nitrogenize the soil?
Well, they do to a certain extent, but I think there's quite a few misconceptions about the way in which legumes actually go about that. Are we going to jump right in? We can jump right in.
What you just said got me. It fired off all these things in my brain. Just to say misconceptions about legumes is very... I'm very excited. I think we should just get right into it. Yeah, let's get right into it. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay. You need to get comfortable or anything, or you need to find a spot of shade or whatever.
I think I actually am going to take a seat in the shade.
Okay, got it. Well, and I am recording, just so you know. I'm just saying that. Giving you the...
Okay, so legumes have the ability to fix atmospheric nitrogen, yes, in partnership with either bacteria or algae. It seems that there's some sort of taxonomic argument what the creatures actually are, but the symbiotic, they're usually referred to as bacteria.
Okay.
And typically... like with peas, they're usually, I think, in the genus Rhizobium.
Right.
And they live in and among the root system of the legumous plant, and they're able to pull atmospheric nitrogen, which is N2 gas, which makes up about 70% of the atmosphere is nitrogen gas.
Mm-hmm.
These small creatures living in association with the roots of legumous plants are able to take that N2 gas and fix it into a form that the plants can use. So it's exchanged into the tissue of the plant. And in exchange for that, the plant provides the bacterium with sugars from photosynthesis.
Wow.
So it's a give and take. So what I'm doing right now is I've got these pea vines that we've been picking for about 4 weeks. And the vines are still green. The peas are pretty much gone. There's no more flowers being formed.
Mm-hmm.
But the nitrogen that was fixed, it's important to remember that nitrogen mostly goes into the tissue of the pea vines.
Okay, so when you're pulling them out, you're getting rid of that.
Well, I'm going to be composting them, so I will be fixing it, and I will be adding it back to the field, but in a somewhat indirect way.
Got it.
I want to plant and Mitsuba into this bed immediately. I'd like to do that today. So I do have the option of digging in the pea vines, or I have the option of laying them on the soil as a mulch and letting them break down. But if I want to immediately form a fine seed bed, I find that just digging them up and shaking off all the soil and composting them gives me a seed bed quickly. So what I do is I'm going to add a bit more compost to that bed, and I'm going to plant some seeds now.
Wow.
Of soil testing and a lot of sort of accurate remineralization work in our field. So the soil has been remineralized according to soil test results, and I think that that's of critical importance.
That's
nitrogen being
that's something
many minerals.
I learned the hard way with my garden is that the mineral content is super important, because for a while I had this really rich, earthy, really the soil was great, but it was filled with like grubs. It was filled with California scarab beetle. What are those little white guys called? The white larva? It's like a grub.
I'm listening to you. I've never heard of a California scarab beetle. But a beetle would have a grub. I believe that's what they're called. The larval form of a beetle is a grub, I think.
Yeah, so that my soil was filled with those things, which is a good sign, but also it's a bad sign in the sense where there's not enough minerals. So I added a bunch of minerals and stuff, the soil really took off.
Awesome. What did you add?
Oh man, I added some oyster lime. I added it's just mixture of stuff that this gardener named Jimmy Williams he recommends. This mixture of I think it's some green sand, oyster lime.
Fantastic.
Probably, geez, what else would it be? It's probably stuff that you use all the time.
There's about 20, maybe 30 commonly used granular soil amendments of various sorts, remineralization ingredients, depending what you want to call them.
Mm-hmm.
We use, typically in our field, according to soil test results, we apply two types of lime, dolomitic limestone and agricultural limestone. So that's calcium carbonate and, in the case of dolomite lime, also magnesium carbonate.
Mm-hmm.
And we add Epsom salt, which is magnesium sulfate, MgSO4. And we add sometimes bone meal, but we're moving away from it. We use calphos, which is rock phosphate, which is a rock that's basically a pure rock mined out of the earth. Or in its raw form, it's mined out of the earth and ground up, and it's high in phosphorus and calcium and trace minerals. We also use certain sulfate salts, namely zinc, manganese, and copper, to raise the levels of those in our soil. And we use borax as well, which is mined out of somewhere in Southern California.
Got
it. Is that where you're at?
I'm in Southern California. I'm in Los Angeles.
Somewhere in the desert, I think they're still mining borax, which is sodium borate. Have you ever seen borax in the, like, 20 Mule Team is the brand we get here?
Yeah, yeah. The people use that for washing clothes.
All kinds of things. Yeah, washing clothes. It's coated as a laundry,
It does something. It kicks it up a notch.
That's right. It kicks laundry up a notch. But it's controversial. A lot of this, everything I've just said to you is controversial. But
really? Controversial among gardeners? Or
use of sulfate salts in particular, I think, based on the soil testing I've done here where I live, we're almost across the board. All the tests I've done have been deficient in zinc, manganese, copper, and boron, to name a few other elements, and quite deficient. And if those things, I mean, it is my belief that if those materials are not present in adequate supply in the soil, they will not be present in the food, and you can't always tell by looking at the food, or necessarily even the food. I think that there's a lot of misconceptions that if something is organic, if a farmer has not used synthetic fertilizers or pesticides of any sort, that somehow that food will be nutrient dense by default. I don't think that's true. And that's a very interesting sort of side of agriculture that I think a lot of folks aren't currently that cognizant of when they're buying food at the grocery store.
Right.
I think we've kind of got this conventional is bad and organic is good, but I think that nutrient density is what we should be talking about. I mean, among other things, it's very good that organic farmers aren't using pesticides. Don't get me wrong. I don't use pesticides or herbicides of any sort, but I don't think it's necessarily the case that the organic farmer down the road is growing more nutrient-dense carrots than the conventional farmer, you know, wherever.
Yeah, because you have this, there's so many elements that go into what composes the whole of a plant that there's just so many different things. So it's a claim that just that
anything.
One change is going to be significant. I want to ask you real quick. I want to just kind of get like an introduction to your whole system, what you're doing. So you run a farm in British Columbia, right? In Vancouver or near Vancouver?
About 250 kilometers northwest, roughly. If you look at a map of British Columbia, you'll see Vancouver Island.
Got
west.
It.
And if about two-thirds of the way up Vancouver Island, there's a town called Campbell River.
Got it.
And if you take a ferry for 10 minutes from Campbell River, you get to Quadra Island. And I live on the southern tip of Quadra Island.
So what is Quadra Island like in terms of ecology and climate zone?
Oh, it's an amazing place. I mean, I'm from Vancouver.
Okay.
It's a bit dry in Vancouver. It's gloomy in the winter, but in the summertime, it's often quite dry and sort of Mediterranean climate. So we're at 50 degrees north latitude, so we've got pretty long days in the summertime.
Wow.
Right, it's dark at like, you know, I'm out in the garden till 10 something.
Oh, man.
In June, I think working in the field is 10:45 in June,
wow.
Late June. But gloomy winters. I like to travel in the winter, in December and January. But it's a pretty good climate for gardening, really. We have a long, slow spring and a long fall, and we have a great climate for a lot of things like all kinds of greens and a lot of interesting Asian vegetables. And my partner Jessica and I, we run it's small. It's like a market garden size. It's about a quarter of an acre of beds.
Got it.
On the south island on a beautiful estate owned by a very forward-thinking businessman, and he seems to like us, and he likes our project, and helps us along. So we don't own the land, but we own this beautiful 75-acre piece of the southern tip of the island, and it's got pretty deep soil, and it's a good place to.
What you're engaged in is you're growing, but the end game is to create a seed bank of sorts, or to sell open pollinated seeds, right?
Well, that was the initial plan.
Okay.
My partner Jessica and I, we do all this together, and we met at horticulture school about 10 years ago in Vancouver, and our original plan when we left the city in 2010 was to start a seed company, and we had a name for it and everything, and we even printed out some envelopes, but we grew our first couple crops of seeds the first couple years and realized that we had a lot more to learn. Mm-hmm. We had a lot more to learn in particular about the genetics of food plants and about the relationship between soil mineralization and seed quality. So we kind of put the seed company on the back burner while we learned these things. And we decided to start selling vegetables because there's massive demand on the island. Much more demand than we had predicted before we moved here, being from the city, for vegetables. There's very little being grown here commercially other than marijuana.
Got it.
There's a market for high quality vegetables and sort of also for horticultural advice. And Jessica and I both work as horticultural consultants and we do some garden work and some planning.
Great.
And just generally people with their gardens. And so, yeah, the goal right now is to grow food and educate people. And the long-term goal is to grow food and educate people and grow seed.
Got it. That's really interesting. I'm looking at the pictures here. So you have a website, ryansgarden.com, but there's also a website for the farm, isn't there?
Right, yeah. Goosefootfarms.com.
Okay. So people can check that out.
Jessica mostly looks after the Goosefoot Farm one, and you'll find a link to her Instagram there, too, with lots of plant pictures.
Yeah, they're all very pretty. I mean, I'm so jealous of some of the stuff you're growing. It looks all so pristine. It's really, really incredible, especially all
well,
the...
You gotta,
yeah, it's just great.
Come up and see it someday.
I would definitely want to.
It's definitely open, and Jessica and I are more and more interested in the idea of connecting with people and connecting people with really basic gardening skills, because we found that there's kind of a gap in horticultural education where sort of if an every man or every woman who with a job with a small amount of land or access to a small amount of land, if they want to learn to grow food in a really practical way, up here at least it's kind of difficult to find a really sort of hands-on let's get the basics first kind of course. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of sort of theoretical stuff, and you know, you can go to university if you want, or college. I went to college, but most of what I learned was in the field and in other people's gardens. And I think there's massive demand right now, at least where I'm at in British Columbia, for people to teach practical gardening skills and to not make it sort of to not over intellectualize it and to not make it all overly technical, but to just teach people the basic things that our grandparents did, you know?
Right. That's the thing I think a lot of people don't realize is that not that long ago, gardening was not very special. It was the thing that everyone did. It was a matter of just daily living. So like the fact that I have two garden boxes in our community garden across the street, and I garden all the time. And I tell people that, and a lot of times people are super impressed by it, but I'm really like, it's not that impressive. What I'm doing is very basic, and it's what everyone used to do for a very long time, because that's just how you lived. Is you had if you had the means, even the slightest means, you would have a kitchen garden because why not? Why would you?
Definitely, of course. And I'm fortunate that I have had a direct connection with my old world ancestry. And my grandmother was a refugee from Western Ukraine, and she grew up in a household of effectively peasants. And you know, they not only grew their own vegetables, but they grew their own grain and potatoes, and they grew their own hemp to make clothing. And this is all before the age of 15 when she left, you know. So you meet someone like that, and it's like, ah, yes. There used to be this, like, it used to not be something that would, like you say, necessarily be impressive, but it would be extremely relevant to your day-to-day life.
Right.
And so, it's a beautiful thing, and it can be done in a city or a town, or like, I'm really a big proponent of not building raised beds, for instance. There's this kind of funny culture of raising up gardens. I don't know about in California, but in British Columbia, at least, particularly in urban places, people want to build raised timber-framed beds.
It's big in California, for sure.
Is it? Okay. Yeah. They want to buy soil and bring the soil in. And there's many instances where that's the only way to go. I mean, granted. But there's also instances where there's topsoil still in place, perhaps growing a lawn or weeds or ornamentals. And we grow a lot of vegetables in non-framed, slightly raised beds or on completely flat land. And that's another sort of grandmotherly skill that seems to have somehow been lost in our quest for, I guess, intensive gardening. I'm a big fan of gardening, but also extensive gardening.
What's the difference between extensive and intensive? And then we'll ask you about the raised beds.
Intensive gardening is a general sort of concept. Often involves planting things as closely as you possibly can together and still enabling them to survive. And a lot of gardening books and gardening education aimed at people who live in an urban setting advocate this. And planting things in a sort of... And there are certain crops for which I do this, and there are certain crops for which it's... appropriate, but often it's advocated that all crops be planted much closer together than any traditional recommendations, and certainly much closer together than your grandmother would have planted them together.
Yeah.
Planted them because there's not much space, because we're in an urban environment. But I think that the density yield curve would surprise a lot of people. For instance, if you've got maybe 10 square feet of garden bed somewhere and you want to grow tomatoes, a lot of people would put 4 plants in 10 square feet. I think that 2 makes more sense.
Okay.
And 1 would certainly, as long as you've got a long enough season, 1 would probably occupy the space quite well too.
So,
and then that 1 plant will be extremely healthy. It'll have a huge root system. It won't be shoulder to shoulder with a bunch of other plants. It won't need as much water. It doesn't even necessarily need as much fertility if it's got room to spread its roots. So there's instances where cramming everything together is really doing urban gardeners in particular a disservice.
I did not know that because I'm a big, like, I look at the companion planting chart almost every day because it's like, to some extent, it rules my life. Like, I'm obsessed with companion planting. I think about it like this weird puzzle where I'm constantly, oh, I can't put the borage next to the, okay, that can go there, but it can't go next to, it's like one of those logic puzzles where you have to get the wolf, the chicken, and the bag of grain across a river, but only one can fit in a boat. So it becomes this thing where that's all I can think about. But think it, from what you just said, it makes it more sense where it probably makes more sense just to have a little more space for things and they would do better.
They will often yield more as well, which is the really beautiful thing. So it's hard to get people to do this. Like what I just described, basically it comes down to thinning a lot of the time, you know. Like if you plant, do you grow beets, Johnny?
I don't like to eat beets. The one vegetable that I don't like to eat because I find that it does a thing to my gastrointestinal system, which is not pleasant.
Oh, fair enough. I think that's common because beets, by all accounts, I have a very healthy gastrointestinal system, right. But beets do amazing things to it, and they sort of hit some kind of flush button.
Yeah.
And everything moves through it.
It moves through, and then also it ends up looking like you're shitting blood, which may be the case or not the case. Either way, I don't like to see that much red in the toilet.
Fair enough.
But what about
anyway,
beets,
but I'm going to use... I'm going to use them as an example anyway. And chard is actually the same species of plant, so you can swap beets and chard in your mind if you like. But if you look at a beet seed, it's actually a compound seed, and the plant produces a number of little seeds and sort of glues them together. Just that's naturally how they're formed. But when you plant beets, often you'll dig a row or you'll scatter them or somehow bury them, you plant them. But more than one of those little seeds in the compound group will often come up.
Mm-hmm.
And if you leave them, as long as those clumps you planted aren't too close together, you know, you'll get a little clump of beets. But if the little clump seeds you've planted are too close together, each one might produce two plants or three plants or even four plants, and those clusters of plants are too close together, often what you're left with is sort of these sickly-looking little beet leaves and tiny little beets, and they don't taste that good, and it's generally disappointing. But I've found that if I give beets about 5 inches apart, each plant about 5 inches apart, and in our case, we typically put them in rows, you know, 8 or 9 inches apart. That's still fairly close together once the plants are growing. The leaves form a canopy at that spacing, but it gives them enough space to make nice and they grow faster and they taste better, and it's just generally, I find, a much nicer experience. But it's hard for people because you're effectively telling somebody to remove part of the plants they've just, you know, carefully gotten to sprout.
Yeah, I find that's kind of hard in the community garden is that people do not want to, because it's like they're so happy and surprised that something has grown, they don't want to take it out. And it's hard. You gotta kill your babies. It's the thing. It's the truth in Hollywood and with like editing and writing. And it's the same in the garden. To make some things work, you have to take out some things that you like to, otherwise they'll ruin the, you won't have anything if you allow everything to grow.
Definitely. And nature does this as well and is not always totally benevolent.
Right, isn't that how a lot of plants become sickly or diseased? It's because they're stressed, because they don't have enough space, or they don't have the... I mean, I guess I didn't realize how much space plays into it. I had no idea, really. I mean, I thin out stuff quite a bit, but I'm just as guilty as a lot of other people of really cramming shit in there, and that's why my strawberries aren't as big and, well, you know, everything like that.
Yeah, like it might be. We give our strawberries about a foot of space right now, and we're pretty careful about pinching off runners, unless we want to propagate that variety. But given a foot of space with runners pinched off regularly, an established planting of strawberries will not only pretty much form a canopy of leaves, but will also produce a beautiful crop.
Yeah, I have a bunch going, but they're pretty thick. I need to thin out the plants. It's so hard, though, because there's such a jungle of plants, it's hard to kind of tell which is the more established plant and what is part of what. Yeah, I just, it confuses me.
Well, find the main plant and try and work backwards to the runners. And don't worry about not runners, because those little pups that they make, they typically will form a total mat if you just leave them, and production will go way down pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think it's what's happened. I think it's definitely what's happened. I thinned them out not that long ago, but I didn't thin them out that much. But this is a pretty well-established patch. It's been there for almost 3 years now, so it's a thing where, like, Yeah, some of it's very established. Even the soil level's even gone down considerably because it's in a raised bed. Well, that's what I want to ask you again about is the raised bed thing, because that is a phenomenon, at least in Southern California. I think other places where people
definitely
are just like, it's an addiction. And there's a person I talked to on Twitter who's a listener of the show, and I see his picture of his garden. He has a huge garden. It's not in raised beds. It's on the ground. I think it's somewhere in the Midwest or something where, but I mean, the big thing I always thought with the whole raised beds was that, I mean, one obviously allows you to do a little more control of the of what's going in as far as soil, but the bigger thing I always thought was pests. Like, it's easier to keep pests out, but I don't know if that's really the case, but I mean, maybe you should talk about it.
Let's talk about it a bit. And it's worth stating again that I'm not against raised beds. There are instances where I very much advocate them, but I think the first thing that you garden or when you're thinking about growing food on a spot is there soil here already? And I mean topsoil. And topsoil is a pretty specific thing. And the word topsoil gets batted around a lot. And there's a lot of dudes all over the world selling truckloads of material as topsoil that is very much not topsoil.
Okay.
Put it that way.
What is topsoil?
There's dudes selling real topsoil. And real topsoil is just the living skin of the earth, effectively. There was a book about it. I think it's called The Ecstatic Skin of the Earth or something like that.
That's cool
what topsoil
book.
Is. Topsoil is the life. And sometimes it's thin. On a lot of my island here, it's an inch thick, if that. But sometimes it's, like in the Midwest, you'd find topsoil sometimes 20 feet deep.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the living layer. It's the layer that's high in organic matter. It's the layer where most of the nutrient exchange in plant roots is going on. It's the layer where most of the fungi are. It's the layer where most of the insect life is. So it's the top. And often if you dig a hole to look at the stratigraphy of the soil, you'll see quite a distinct, depending on the soil and geology, you'll see quite a distinct barrier. And you'll have this either brown or black or various colored topsoil, and then there'll be a very definite line, and then there'll be some other kind of soil, or there'll be clay, or there'll be rock.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the material that naturally forms on the very top, mostly through biological action and weathering of rocks. So that's a few.
That's interesting.
That's what topsoil is. Now, if you build a box and then you're left with a question, what do I fill it with? So if you've built a box on land that has no topsoil, which is often the case in a suburban development or an urban area, often the topsoil has long since been trucked away, sold or buried or whatever. But often the topsoil is gone. So in that case, yes, you build a box and you need to fill it with something. And you're best filling it with the closest thing to topsoil you can get, or actual topsoil if you can get it. But that's going to require
a lot of work.
You know, footwork or emails. Yeah, but you've got to check. And honestly, if I was building a raised bed garden today, I wouldn't fill it with anything until I'd sent a sample of the material to the lab that I use.
Mm-hmm.
Can I promote a lab?
Well, sorry, what was that?
Can I promote a soil lab here? Because I'm about to start.
No, do it.
Logan Labs in Lakeview, Ohio is who I use, and it costs $25 US to have a composite sample of soil analyzed in a very good state-of-the-art facility in a result format that you can easily either perform calculations on yourself or plug into a soil remineralization calculator. So there is a lab, and you certainly don't need to have any kind of scientific expertise to learn to take a composite sample. So I would be inclined to spend the $25 from a source that I was going to buy a bunch of soil from and then get the results and then think about whether I was comfortable trying to remineralize that soil if I need to and look at the lab results and they'll tell you a lot about what's going on all in one shot. It's a beautiful thing for $25.
Got it. So that's when you do that and you can know what to fill your bed with. You're filling it with you're filling it with good topsoil as opposed to something that's either dead or... Yeah, I mean, it's so funny. I've seen so many different things happen in the community garden. You see stuff that you're like, how did a person think that that was the right thing to do? Like, how did they get to that point? Like,
I love that as a title for a gardening book. That would be a great title for a gardening book.
Yeah, how did they think that was the right thing to do?
Everywhere I go, I check out community gardens because they're an amazing... You can see laid out in front of you dozens or even hundreds of people's different interpretation of how do I grow food. And often they're all given a roughly the same amount of square footage, and often they all have the same water source. Sometimes they all have the same compost or manure source, depending. But you can see different minds at work, and it's amazing because it really shows you that there isn't one way to do things. There's not one right way to grow any crop, really. There's a whole bunch of right ways and a whole bunch of sort of okay ways and a whole even larger bunch of terrible ways. But you can see the variety, and you can sort of pick and choose and Community gardens are extremely useful, as are farms, as are organic farms, but as well conventional farms. And if you're wondering about like how to space strawberries or tomatoes or something, don't discount what you can learn by just looking at a conventional farmer's field.
Right, because that's their job. It works. If it works for the person who's growing them for a living, that might be a good way to look at it.
It might be. And with row spacing and plant spacing, it doesn't always have to do with... like, often plants are spaced a certain way to allow their roots to expand, and the roots will expand well into the pathway and sometimes into the adjacent bed. I've seen diagrams in books of the roots of tomato plants and other plants plotted out. There was a lot of studies done, I think, in Russia, of all kinds of agricultural studies, but there's some diagrams that are available that show tomato root systems well over 5 feet deep and 5 feet wide one plant. So that's going, you know, under your path and into the bed adjacent, potentially, and potentially into the adjacent path, depending how things are arranged. But sometimes what you see on a farm has to do with machinery as well. So it's important to sort of tease that out. Like, some row spacing and whatnot has to do with getting a tractor into the field, right, or getting a harvest field. But it's value. You can learn information from any kind of garden anywhere in the world, I think.
Can you so you're talking about how you educate people as far as with gardening? You teach all different levels of people. What's like some of the most basic stuff you talk about when you're first talking to people? Because you were talking before how it's a thing where when you're starting off with the basics, it can be difficult because just misconceptions and just what people think is the right thing that's not, and vice versa.
Yeah, I usually try and give people a pep talk to relax them if they're about to really start gardening, and just tell them sort of what you just said, like that you're going to be given a lot of information. I'm going to give you a lot of information. Books are hopefully going to give you a lot of information. Other people are going to give you information. And as with almost anything, you're going to have to filter that information. But with gardening in particular, there's a lot of old wives' tales mixed in with good science, mixed in with okay science, mixed in with something that worked for one person. And I think it's very important for people to remember that every soil is different. And soils are like snowflakes, you know. They're all different. And aspect is often different. You need, at my latitude at least, you typically need full sun for all plants. So we talk a little bit about what that means. And basically it means a south or a west or a completely open exposure up here. And I try and sort of demystify that a little bit, because you'll have some people will be out in a potential site and they'll actually time how long it's sunny at different times of year. But it can be done with a compass helps as well. So we try and find a good aspect, and then we try and talk about soil and how, soils are different, and testing is a very good thing and can be your friend. And I try and demystify that a little bit. And I try and talk about some of how mythology interacts with practical advice with soil. And there's a lot of, for a long time, I used a lot of horse manure. And I still use some horse manure, not nearly as much as I used to. And I know a lot of people who use tons of horse manure. It's the only material that goes in their gardens. And it doesn't always make for the best garden. And since I've started using quite a bit less horse manure, I've had better gardens. Now, my techniques have changed in other ways as well, but it's one thing I think to think about is that you don't necessarily need 3 inches of compost or manure or chicken manure or whatever incorporated into your soil to make it healthy. Sometimes what soils need is a balanced prescription, you know?
Right.
And if you've tested it, you know what you're starting with, and you're way ahead of the game. But even if you're not going to test it, I typically recommend people, first think about aspect, and then think about if there is any soil on site, and then think about what can we do based on previous results with soils here without testing. What can we add to the soil and make a good prediction will work in terms of granular amendments? So we talk about just getting the soil ready, and then we talk about ways to get rid of turf, because typically what we have in sunny, cleared land up here anyway is grass of some kind or other, weeds of some kind or other. So I discussed the 3 or 4 major ways that I know of to convert that kind of ecosystem into a vegetable or herb ecosystem.
What about Bermuda grass?
I don't think that grows up here.
No, we have a terrible blight of Bermuda grass. It's just like, that stuff is so voracious. It's unbelievable.
Does it have a rhizome, like an underground stem that creeps right below the soil?
It's rhizomal, yeah, and it's amazing. Like, it's a fucking alien. It really is. I don't know how, you just can't kill it.
Like, there's plants that actually seem... Aliens, almost a good word to describe them. I feel like I use that word to describe asparagus, which we've got that's about 2 or 3 years old now, that's really starting to grow, and it kind of looks like it's from another planet. Mm-hmm. And there's a few other plants like that, too. Like, do you know morning glory?
Yeah, I've been growing morning glories for almost half of my life at this point. Yeah,
it's beautiful. There's many species, but we have one species here that's a very much a perennial rhizomatous species that it seems like it's uncanny how well adapted it is to spread through what we're trying to do to the ecosystem as humans.
Yeah, it's very voracious. People hate it, but I think it just grows like crazy.
Yeah, it's beautiful. All plants. I mean, I don't want to sound like some preachy. I don't want to sound all preachy, but because I'm not, I'm actually a pretty negative person except for about gardening, but all plants are doing something, you know, like, and all insects and all life forms are really, they're all doing something, and none of them are going to prevent you from having a garden in a space, typically, unless we're talking about, like, big trees or something, but
right.
A lot of the time, there's things to live with them, and, you know, I have morning glory in some parts of the garden, and we coexist with it, and horsetail we coexist with, and but some plants are definitely more able to just do it on their own, like, yeah. Horsetail, well, morning glory, opium.
You said opium?
Opium follows people around. Yeah, it's a plant that follows gardeners around, and it seeds in such a way that, at least up here, I mean, it's been in every garden I've ever had.
See, that's interesting you say that, because I have struggled to grow Papaverum sinifera.
Sit down, son, and I will tell you a tale of how to do it.
Okay.
You plant it in the winter.
Right. I did that. I mean, obviously, Southern California is a little bit different than a lot of places just because how dry it is, and especially how dry it's been lately. But
What's happened when you planted it?
Well, this past year it was successful and did well, but it wasn't nearly. I had to seed so much to get enough, and I'm thinning the seeds constantly as they're getting bigger. It's just something where not as many took as I thought, and this was like the third or probably the third time I've really, really tried to grow them from seed.
Interesting. Well, the way that when I have cultivated, now it's mostly naturalized here, but when I have cultivated it, or when my friend has cultivated it, I lay it on the soil surface in the wintertime,
mm-hmm.
and cover it not at all really, and then thin the plants to about a foot or even a bit more apart.
Okay.
Because they're very big.
Yeah, they're huge. They get really big.
But it's also, your climate may just be a little warm because a lot of the places where it's grown commercially are very cold winters and then quick warm springs. And then I think it's harvested, like the commercial crop, I think, in the Middle East is harvested in about April, May.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, I remember reading the article Michael Pollan wrote about Papaver, and he talks about, a lot of people talk about that, just how there's this sort of misinformation about it, and actually it pretty much can grow anywhere, and it's not that exotic or special, it's just it's that we think that it is, and because of that it's people, and that's what I always point out to people, like the, you know bus ads, like the bus bench ads, in Los Angeles, when they're blank, when they're not being used, the image that they put on there is a poppy field. And it's so funny. There's all these images in popular culture just everywhere that are pictures of opium-producing poppies. And
wait, Johnny, are you sure that the image you're talking about is Papaver somniferum, though? Because there's a bunch of other papavers, and there are sometimes like the in Flanders fields where poppies grow. Those aren't opium poppies.
Well, they're definitely not California poppies, which I know aren't even true poppies.
Oh.
I don't know if it's some different. They're definitely poppies, for sure.
And, yeah.
And
yeah,
whether or not they're somniferum is, you know, it's like an artist rendering, so you can't exactly tell.
Oh, I see.
I still think it's funny that this thing that is so like demonized is also everywhere. All the time, and you just don't even realize that it's there.
Yeah, and it's a very odd because we create semi-synthetic opioids out of it that are then, you know, massively prescribed all over the world for all kinds of things. You know, like it's grown and the morphine is extracted, and then that's turned into all manner of OxyContin and what have you.
All kinds of weird offshoots that are unnatural and not as safe as something that would be.
But it must be pointed out that even in its raw form, having used it a number of times in my life, I wouldn't consider it a safe compound.
Yeah, not safe, but I suppose safe in the sense to where the chemical compound is, I don't know, more organic, or at least it's closer to something that's you feel better about ingesting as opposed to some thing that's, who knows what it is. I'm always going to pick Nature's Lab over the lab with white coats in terms of something that I'm going to eat.
And poppy is a really great plant to illustrate how people can take that sort of, if they want, they can take that power back, because there's a lot of plants like that you can grow that can heal and be very easily cultivated in amongst all of the other useful edible plants and fragrant plants and ornamental plants.
I'm looking at this picture you have right now of this. This is some brassica, you say? It's a Matthiola longipetalia. Is that how you say it? Evening scented stocks.
Oh, yeah. I think it's Matthiola. It's a brassica. It's related to broccoli and cabbage and all that whole group. It's in the same family.
Hello?
Oh, are you still there?
Yeah, you said that's a remarkable, is that what you're about to say? Cut out.
Yeah, it's remarkable. It closes up tight during the day. Like right now, I can actually see it from where I'm sitting. The flowers are completely closed up tight, and then at night, right before it gets dark, or a couple hours before it gets dark, they open up wide and they release this exotic fragrance that's really just really otherworldly.
So I think, could I grow those in Southern California, you think?
I think that in Southern California, evening scented stocks would probably be like an autumn, winter, maybe early spring annual, I guess. Because you're like zone 11, maybe?
I guess.
Is that correct? 10?
See,
the zone thing is...
Yeah, it's weird because I feel like that zone... Yeah, like you're saying, the zone thing is weird because it doesn't take into account microclimes and stuff. And I think because I live by the LA River in sort of a lower depression, that I think we get a lot more... a lot more moisture, a lot more dew, and just the weather's a little bit different, I think.
You live near the LA River?
Yeah.
So is there, I feel like I read an article recently about some kind of river. Are they cleaning up that river and making it like kayakable, or did I imagine that?
They already are. It's been kayakable, but now people are kayaking in there. They have like a little thing set up during the summers where you can kayak down like a mile portion of the river. And they're cleaning it up. There's a huge federal grant that just came through. I don't know how many millions of dollars, but it's a big federal grant devoted just for the river. So, I mean, it's not just for cleaning so much. It's going to be even bigger than cleaning it. They're basically going to change the whole nature of the river to be like how every river is in every other fucking place in the whole world, where it's something you look at as opposed to have your back to. Make it like a focal point as... Because the LA River is so maligned, it's absurd. It's like, if you say that word, people are like, what? Oh, gross. When really, they've never even fucking seen it. Yeah.
It really interests me. I'm very interested in sort of like where kind of what used to be wild waterways come into cities. That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to see.
It's pretty cool.
LA's on my list. So.
You should check it out. There's a great... I'm going to have someone on the show eventually. There's this project called Fowler, Friends of the LA River, and it's run by a bunch of geniuses who have really, like, for the past 20 years been ramming to get some attention and money and all this other stuff for the river, and it's finally come to fruition. So it's going to be some cool stuff happening there in the future.
Fantastic.
I want to ask you two things before we go. One, is there like a plant that you can talk about that you think that a lot of people don't know about that's interesting, maybe just has some interesting aspects to its growth, or something that you think is that really is interesting to you that people wouldn't know about?
Oh, there's a bunch.
There's tons. I know. It's like a thing where it's like picking your favorite child out of 1,000 children. But
yeah. Here's one for you. Chrysanthemum coronarium is a type of annual chrysanthemum, and it's grown as a leafy green in a lot of East Asia, particularly Japan. In Japan, it's called, I believe it's pronounced Shungiku, Shungiku. But it's Chrysanthemum coronarium, or garland chrysanthemum in English. And it's a great green. It's a great cool season green, and it grows very well. It interplants. We were mentioning interplanting. I've grown it quite close to other things with great success.
Like what things do you grow next to?
Well, I grew next to a new planting of strawberries, and I put a row of strawberries a foot apart down the center of a 3-foot-wide bed, and I flanked the row of strawberries on either side with a direct-seeded row of this shungiku in March. And starting in about late May and carrying on through till now, we've been harvesting the plants by just slashing them back and eating the shoots. And the leaves and the flower buds and the new shoots in particular are just, they have this delicate, they have a beautiful texture and a really delicate taste that just works really well. And I do a lot of green smoothies. I do a lot of green smoothies with steamed greens.
Okay.
Sort of a paradigm shift for a lot of people, but I believe that some greens are best eaten raw and some are best eaten actually lightly steamed. And I try and eat a mixture of those two. But with shungiku, I do both raw and steamed in smoothies. It's used in soups often. It's my understanding that it's often thrown in, like the type of hot pot that they make in Sichuan in southwestern China. I think that it's common to throw shungiku leaves in at the end of the hot pot and then eat the broth as a soup.
Ooh, that sounds good.
It's not generally cooked at high temperatures. Apparently that makes it bitter. But I read that years ago, and I've never stir-fried it or anything after having read that, and usually eat it raw or lightly cooked, and it's a beautiful plant, and if you let it flower, you get this great spray of, like, white-yellow chrysanthemum flowers.
And what, it's a wonderful plant. What would you compare it to as far as taste goes, as far as other greens?
I feel like the texture is like good spring spinach, and the taste is mild and somewhat unique and maybe a little floral.
Oh, cool. Sounds good.
Yeah.
That sounds great. And I'm try it out.
That's worth trying, yeah, shungiku, chrysanthemum coronarium. And there's another plant that is more common globally, but is, I find, underused, is the broad bean or the fava bean.
Yeah, fava beans, man. Those have the coolest leaves. Yeah. I love the way they look. They look like little, kind of like, I mean, back to aliens, but they have that, they look up, their leaves are so aggressive looking. I love the way they're so sharp.
Yeah,
you know?
Mother out weeds nicely, and the yields from them, I find if I plant them early enough in the spring and give them a bit of space, about 7 inches between plants, the yields are often phenomenal, and they're just a beautiful vegetable. We eat them raw when they're young, after being shelled, and we steam them lightly and saute them and whatnot when they're a bit more mature, but the amount of food you get is often phenomenal, and they're
cool.
Yeah, they're beautiful, and you are still getting nitrogen, like to loop back to the start of the conversation. If you slash back your fava beans when you're done harvesting them and compost the tops, you're going to lose some of that nitrogen in the composting process, yes, but you're also going to keep some of it. So it will be, in my opinion, you'll have a net gain of nitrogen to your garden, even if you don't, you know, till them in or grind them up into mulch in place.
Got it.
You certainly can do it.
Now, we're kind of like halfway through the summer growing season, I feel like, at least where most people are who don't have the crazy cool climate zones that we live in. Is there like some advice, maybe a couple things you could tell people to either to get things going? I mean, I guess it's not too late to plant some stuff, but I just wonder if a couple things right now to throw out there as far as people who are gardening and have been gardening and want to.
The advice I would give is that most people have a much longer planting season than they think. I mean, I can't speak for Southern California or really most of North America. I can sort of speak for what would be referred to as the Pacific Northwest climate, which is where I am, sort of zone 7-ish. But we've got a long planting season. I'm going to be planting today. I'm going to carry on direct seeding things in the field through about mid-August. I think the last thing that we'll plant, other than garlic, will be in mid to late August in the field. And we're still planting tons of flats of transplants and doing second crops. A lot of what I do at this time of year is, for instance, the spring planting of peas comes out and some spinach and mitsuba go in there. Or a spring planting of carrots has recently been replanted with lettuce, or, you know, succession planting. And with many of my beds in this field, I can get two crops, sometimes three crops a year. But well-planned successions help a lot. So if you know when your garlic is going to come out, and you know what you're going to plant, like, and you possibly you already have some transplants ready to go in that place, you can get a great second crop often with a lot of things. Like, we pull out carrots from the early planting and then plant zucchini, for instance,
mm-hmm.
and that enables us to get a great crop of carrots from the spring planting, and then a great crop of zucchini starting in about August, September for an autumn, you know, from a summer planting.
So
anyway.
You're talking about putting them in where the carrots were. You put the zucchini in after you've pulled the carrots out.
Yeah, that's right. So a lot of our beds are 150 square feet, and if I've got 150 square feet of carrots, you know, I might harvest that over weeks, depending what we're doing with them and who's buying them. And then I've got plenty of time. If it's a, from a spring planting of carrots that I start harvesting in June, I've got plenty of time to put in a planting of cucumbers or zucchini in early or mid-July, particularly if I've already got them started from transplant.
Cool.
So yeah, the bed will produce a whole crop of carrots, and then it'll produce a nice late crop of zooks or cukes or other types of summer squash.
Nice.
And there's a bunch of different things. Like, we'll often take out garlic and we'll plant broccoli transplants, for instance, or we'll cut down our tomatoes in October and then we'll plant garlic right into the decaying root system of the tomatoes. No need to pull that out.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, that works beautifully with tomatoes. And we find that we cut them down and we typically compost the tops, plant the garlic, and then we spread any organic fertilizer that we're going to use that year. And then we put a bit of compost, some kelp, and some mulch just sort of in layers. And we find that the garlic grows really well through the decaying root system of the tomato crop. And the timing works well, and it's a good no-till way to switch crops, so you're not bringing up a bunch of weed seeds from the subsoil or from the rest of the topsoil, and you're sort of not disturbing things. And there's a lot to be said for that. There's some folks who take it to an extreme, and I actually used to take it to an extreme and used to be a real advocate of no-till gardening and permanent mulch and lasagna gardening only. And now we use some mulch and we do some lasagna gardening and sheet mulching and whatnot, but I do a bit more bare soil cultivation now, which I used to think was really wrong. I used to think that if land wasn't mulched, it was in a constant state of degradation and erosion and nutrient loss. And I guess it sort of is to a certain extent, but I don't think everything needs to be mulched all the time anymore.
Got it. Yeah, I think the mulching, it seems like for Southern California, the main thing is just water retention to save on water. That's the weird thing, even in Southern California, where we obviously have a huge water shortage, I find that still constantly overwatering is the death of everyone's plants. I went on a tour for almost 10 days and I had someone watch my garden, which is, it's never as good as when someone watches your garden as when you do. And I mean, she definitely watered it, but I'm pretty sure she probably didn't water it that much. And I came back to this huge harvest, and I think it was because I wasn't there that much, even though it was some pretty hot temperatures. Those roots they're so deep, they can hold on for a long time without water.
And it ties directly into the spacing issue, because it's related to spacing. And if you've allowed your tomato plant to have roots 5 feet deep and 5 feet wide, it's going to be a heck of a lot more drought tolerant than a tomato plant that's shoulder to shoulder with a bunch of others and has, you know, its root system and its top growth are both very much limited by competition with its neighbors. And in that case, you're going to have to water a lot more often. So in many instances, you can grow more food with less water if you give things a bit more space.
So what about eggplant? Because I don't grow any tomatoes anymore, because everyone grows so many tomatoes that I feel like I don't need to grow them. So I've been this year I'm focusing on okra, eggplant, and cucumbers. Those are my three main things. And eggplants are the same family as tomatoes, right?
Correct, yeah.
So I can kind of...
Well, it's eggplant. They need quite a bit more heat than I have up here.
Okay.
So last year we grew eggplant. I mean, our main limiting factor is just sort of we often have dull weather and we're at 50 degrees north latitude. So I don't have quite enough solar energy hitting the ground to produce very good eggplants outside of a greenhouse. But eggplants I have seen growing in many different gardens in the tropics, often as a perennial. And I can recall seeing eggplants in Southeast Asia spaced quite far apart, grown with woody tree-like stalks that were a number of years old.
Cool.
They were producing crops. So I don't know. You might have cold snaps that might finish them off in the winter, or you might not, but you probably have a much more favorable climate for eggplants than I do. If I was in Los Angeles growing eggplants and okra, I would plant them reasonably far apart. I would probably give my eggplants at least 3 feet apart.
Oh, what? That's not the case for mine right now. I mean, I think I might take one of them out, because they're doing really well. Yeah. They're doing great.
The eggplants that I'm referring to that I saw growing as tree-like specimens in the tropics were about 4 or 5 feet apart.
Okay, but they're huge. Yeah, I suppose they must be gigantic.
I mean, the tomato root system of 5 feet deep and 5 feet wide, I think, is a conservative estimate of how deep they can go. And an eggplant is probably similar given the right soil and sort of the right amount of initial, like a good stress-free early life. I think if given enough space, I don't think it's unreasonable to expect an eggplant to have a super extensive root system too. And they're a long-lived plant. They're going to occupy your garden bed for quite a while. And I think if they're well-grown, they're going to give you quite a bit of fruit. So, one plant if well grown, could produce tons of fruit. So yeah, I give them at least 3 feet apart. And if honestly, if I had the space in a climate like yours, probably 4 or 5.
Yeah, I'm gonna rip one of them out, I think, today. So because it's underproducing. I think it's being choked a bit. That makes sense.
If anyone at the community garden gives you a hassle about ripping one of them out, you can just say that some strange man you talked on the phone, you know, in Canada this morning told you to.
I will. No one gives me guff at my community garden. I'm the compost captain. So.
You're the compost captain?
I am.
What's your composting system? Is it hot compost or passive compost?
It's I guess you'd say it's hot compost. We have one of those. It's a very, very typical plan of the three bins that are screened in, and they have the boards you pull out from the front, and we have one that's ready to take out, one that's cooking, and then one that's you put into. And so.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah, and we It's actually been going a lot better lately because, I don't know, I think when I started adding a lot of decayed leaf matter as the brown, like I'll go down by the river and I'll just rake in a whole big garbage barrel filled with like decayed leaf matter, like aspen or willow. I think it's aspen trees actually. And so,
okay.
And I add that like huge amounts of it after like every couple of days, so to keep it real, a lot of brown in there, because people add a lot of wet stuff, and people don't chop up their stuff very much, so I have to go through there like every couple of days with a machete and just fucking break my back trying to chop up all this crap people put in there. But it tends to be, it's been heating up really well. I sprinkle some alfalfa in there when I can, and I till it as much as I can, and it gets pretty goddamn hot.
Right.
Yeah.
Composting is a wonderful first thing to teach people. Going back to sort of what do you teach people first, I think composting is a really good place to start as well. And just showing people that it can be done really easily. I'm a big advocate of stockpiling materials when I can. I'll stockpile crop debris, and we stockpile kitchen scraps and wet things in a separate rat-proof container, and we stockpile manure under a tarp. And when we've got enough things, and things like lawn clippings and leaves and whatnot, and when we've got enough things stockpiled, we assemble them all in a layer method, in a, you know, just a bin like you described. Maybe this one's made out of pallets, and we assemble it all at once and wet it down. And it if it's turned after a couple weeks and then turned again after a couple more weeks, it's usable extremely quickly.
Wow. So what is that called? What you're talking about?
Well, that's called hot composting or thermophilic composting. The creatures that are heating it up are thermophiles as opposed to mesophiles. And I think they're mostly bacteria. And yeah, they're just their metabolic byproduct. Just their heat byproduct of their metabolism is what heats it up to about, I think it's optimum is, I think, about 150 to 160 Fahrenheit. And we reach those temperatures hot enough to cook an egg.
That's hot. And then when I think mine gets about 130 maybe, which is still pretty fucking hot.
I think that the difference one might find between sort of optimum and maybe slightly suboptimum, and I mean, it depends who's optimum you're even talking about, but would be maybe slightly less sterilization of seeds and possibly disease.
Yeah.
I'm not really that concerned about that because we have a pretty good weed control program by hoeing and hand weeding here, but and I'm not too worried about the disease thing either, but it is an issue sometimes. Like, we find that tomato seeds, no matter how hot it gets, the seeds from tomatoes that wind up in the compost, they seem to be all viable when we spread the compost the next spring, and they're one of our main weeds now.
It's kind of it's interesting how that works. I have a watermelon growing in my garden right now. It's huge, and it's a volunteer.
Oh, cool.
And
I'd step over my watermelon.
What's that?
I'd love to grow. I said I'd step over my own mother to grow watermelon.
Oh,
sorry if you're listening to this.
It's too cold there, huh?
Well, we've got some melons, but they're really sulking. Yeah, too cold. So this is a volunteer from your compost?
Yeah, I guess so. It just started growing. I had a squash one. I don't really like squash. I ripped the squash out. I think it was also competing with the okra. But
You don't like squash?
I'm not a fan of squash. Never have been. I don't know why.
I wasn't either until very recently, and then I grew some squash that blew my mind wide open, and I was like, oh my God, what have I been missing?
What kind of squash?
And I realized that I like squash that's extremely sweet and extremely dry. It was actually seed smuggled over from Japan. And it's unbelievable. We got some more seed and we got some more squash growing now. And they're these long, I mean, they're what would be referred to as a winter squash. They're definitely Cucurbita maxima. There's four major species of squash grown and they're in the maxima group, and they're extremely dry and extremely sweet. And they're just, I roast them and they're this beautiful, I mean, they just changed the way I think about squash. Your mileage may vary because some people don't like any kind of squash, but
yeah.
I found that I was eating spaghetti squash, which is really bland, or I was eating like squash that didn't have very much sugar and was really moist and kind of gloppy, and it didn't do anything for me. But when I discovered this kind of dry, sweet stuff, totally changed my impression.
What's it called again?
Well, this is just some kind from Japan. I have the Japanese speaker that I am friends with knows the name of the variety in Japanese, but I can never remember it. But it's a long, it's Cucurbita maxima for sure. It's okay. Definitely in the maxima. And in the maxima family, you'll also find the pink banana. And a lot of the squash that up here are just sort of nebulously called kabocha, which is just the Japanese word for squash. But a lot of those are the sort of maximas too. And buttercups are maximas as well. Mm. I find that maximas are, the tastiest squash. They seem to do the best for us up here.
Cool. So much information. I'm very pleased. So it's,
it's fun just freestyling here about gardening. Like, it's nice to just have a conversation about. It's the one thing, I listen to a lot of podcasts, and it's one thing that I always want to hear on podcasts that I almost never hear is discussion of gardening and discussion of sort of plant-based nutrition. And those two things seem to be completely absent. And even discussions that are leading in that direction on podcasts, I find they often veer off at, you've got to eat a well-balanced diet and take some mineral supplements or whatever, you know, take a multivitamin. But the discussion of sort of soil health as it relates to plant health, as it relates to sort of human physical performance, seems to be absent. And I mean, I'm not a doctor, but there's got to be a connection, you know?
I think so. It's all one big circle of death. I think
it's beautiful, though. It's empowering.
Yeah.
It's one of the only truly empowering things I found in my life. Like, really, really fundamentally emancipating is to be able to grow and hunt a portion of my own food and trade a portion of my own food, and just to be involved in that whole cycle has really it really feels empowering.
It is, yeah. So does eating strawberries until you're sick that you don't have to pay for.
Totally.
It's goosefootfarms.com. It's also, you have ryansgarden.com, and people can check that out. Thanks so much for talking to me, Ryan. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate the opportunity, Johnny. And if you ever come up here, you're certainly more than welcome to come and enjoy the farm with us.
Great. And we should talk again maybe a little before this next spring to get people in the mood and kind of get some kickstart the growing season when it returns back around again.
Johnny, I'd love to be on anytime.
All right. Be well.
You too, Johnny. It was great to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
There you have it. There you have it. There you have it. There you have it. Groundbreaking kindness intellectuals. Thank you for listening. Please enjoy this song from a man named Kid Hum from his new album Fossil Fuel 2. This is the first track. I love this entire album. It's like listening to a bath. If a bath were able to be listened to. I do.
You don't want to break my headphones. You think it's messing with me? I will have to bust a 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 Make me.
Oh, shit. I let this city a lot like a rollerblade. I like this city a lot like a hot dog.
I can't believe how cold it is. It's so cold in here.
As a branch of the United States government, it is the mission of the National Security Agency to assess and flag citizens of the country who may present a threat to its security. The NSA has clearance to wiretap by any means necessary.
Tapped. Incidental recordings of private conversations from the files of the NSA.
Now on feralaudio.com.